Hi, and welcome to Grantham's Risk and Regulation Unravelled podcast. This is our monthly ramble through the emerging world of financial services regulation in the UK. I am David Morrie, who's slightly cold-ridden, I apologise in advance, and I'm joined by my in rude good health colleague, Ben Farmer. Say hello, Ben.
Hello. Joining David virtually today to make sure it stays that way.
Yeah, I'm quarantined for the sake of the rest of the human race. However, we've got a bit to talk about this month, Ben. I suppose the place to lead with, or thing to lead with, is the FCA issuing their business plan. So, as listeners will know, this is the annual publication the FCA produces, setting out its priorities for the coming year. I think it's probably fair to say that it's a close evolution to what we've had for the last 3 years. So the FCA changed this format of its business plan about 3 years ago. I think in part to reflect the fact that the traditional business plan, which would set out sector by sector, specific plans, specific initiatives, specific developments, and that's kind of been superseded by the regulatory initiatives grid. So, you know, you could see what the if you like checklist of activities are within the grid, within the rig, and the business plan has become much more of an articulation of the FCA strategy and its progress against its, in this case, 3 year strategy. And actually, this is year three of that strategy, final year of that strategy, which makes me think we potentially will be hearing stuff later this year about, you know, what will become their new strategy to follow this one. And it's fair to say, I think, as well, that the business plan therefore looks a lot like it did last year, actually. In fact, when it appeared 3 weeks early, I did momentarily think, oh my God, they've accidentally published last year's by mistake. But no, it is different, and it articulates the strategic priorities that the FCA are working towards. It talks about 13 commitments, doesn't it, Ben? So those are the same 13 commitments that we've had for a couple of years. So these are, if you like, the thematic focus areas the FCA considers at the top of its agenda. And I guess you've been through the plan, Ben, notwithstanding the fact that I've just said there's not much new in it. is there anything that you particularly pulled from it?
I guess the one thing that's a bit new is obviously the FCA now has this secondary objective, doesn't it, of facilitating the international competitiveness of the UK economy. So I think this is the first time we've seen this properly integrated into a business plan. And you mentioned there's the 13 commitments, and they've sort of put them in order, and this is third, so it's near the top of the list. I think politically it had to be near the top of the list to show they're paying attention to it. That said, frankly, the actual content on it looks a little bit thin to me, which perhaps brings us back to a discussion we've had before about, is a secondary objective really an objective? As usual, the FCA's commentary on facilitating international competitiveness, there's a bit of stuff in there about sandboxes and things, but yeah. There's also a lot about to be internationally competitive, we need to have good standards, i.e. to be competitive, we're going to keep doing what we were doing already.
Yeah, it's that high international standards, I think, the terminology that gets used, isn't it? But that's right, yes. I agree, there's not, you know, any seismic proposals within that area of that commitment area. I suppose weaved across the business plan as a whole, though, we are seeing quite a bit that relates to the use of technology within the sector. Cryptos gets a mention, T+1 settlement gets a mention, and the sort of the FCA, you know, willing to play its role to sort of facilitate rules that make these things legally possible in the UK. So I think there was a sort of we're going to make sure that our rules reflect sort of modern technology and the opportunities of that modern technology, which kind of comes through. Yeah, you're right. The 13, that's number three. I mean, the number one actually is financial crime, isn't it? So you know, don't ever underestimate the focus the FCA have on financial crime. It's their number one, well, top of the list, I suppose, but it's certainly their headline commitment to continue to eliminate financial crime within the UK financial services system. And consumer protection is number two, where they talk about testing of consumer duty compliance. That's the headline, isn't it? Some fairly vigorous testing to take place.
Yeah, do you know, is it bad that I think even I'm starting to get Consumer Duty fatigue slightly now? I sort of somewhat glossed over that session. I just went, oh, look, Consumer Protection, it's Consumer Duty again. There's a surprise. It's probably
yeah, no, I know.
Anyone else really? But
I think you should be ashamed of yourself, Ben. Absolutely. It gives us a nugget of it's worth reading that section, albeit you know it's quite high level. It does, but you know, it talks about something I guess we already know from seeing you know other activity the FCAs have or are conducting in the industry. So it talks about focus on product value. And it talks about focus on vulnerable customers. So if you like, those are legs of the Consumer Duty, which are being pulled out specifically. If you want to know where the initial priorities are, it looks like product value and vulnerable customers are at top of the list when it comes to Consumer Duty compliance. I picked out, you know, they're talking about getting in place a new regime for market abuse as it relates to crypto assets. I think that's part of the bigger picture about pulling stablecoin or crypto assets into the regulatory regime more generally. But it looks like financial crime aspects of it or the market abuse aspects are going to be, one of the first areas, along with financial promotions, where crypto gets dragged into the regulatory perimeter. And also financial resilience. They talk about, you know, they're expecting more firm failures because of, you know, market challenges, possibly also the effect of the Consumer Duty, but let's not draw that connection. And therefore there'll be a focus on wind down planning, or checking, you know, probing firms on the status of their wind down plans, language around more assertive supervision of principal firms, so appointed representative principal firms. That was a you know, if you want to look at a small fragment of a sentence and read a lot into it, then that's what I did in that case. The firms with big AR networks are probably going to be getting more attention than they have. Anything else from the business plan from your perspective?
I don't think much else. I think on the financial crime point, it was interesting that so for each of these commitments, the FCA sort of listed the outcomes it wants to see. And the top two of the three under financial crime were slow the growth in investment fraud victims and losses and slow the growth in authorised push payment fraud cases and losses.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've seen recently some other more specific actions coming out of the FCA on APP fraud. So it's, again, as you said, that the cost of living and the wider economic background kind of runs through all of this business plan to some degree, doesn't it? I think it's, you know, even the financial crime element, which to some degree you could say is a fairly obvious black and white, well, financial crime is bad, so of course they're cracking down on it, but there's also still clearly a sort of cost of living trying to keep more money in customers' pockets angle there.
Yeah, protect them from fraud, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. As he's talking of money, I suppose worth mentioning at a headline level, they're proposing just over 10% budget increase. So the budget would be 755 million, I think it is. They're expecting to just top 5,000 employees. So they're getting bigger. There's quite a significant step up. As employers, they call out, you know, some of the specific areas of work that are, if you like, driving a higher budget. So, for instance, they talk about the 11.3 million being needed for the smarter regulatory framework. So that's basically the onshoring, amending, tailoring European Union rules. So and various other initiatives get called out in terms of spend. There's about another 40 million on technology development. There's reference to, you know, using AI within their supervisory processes to, I guess, analyze data and look for issues. So it's quite, the FCA is clearly not intending to stand still in terms of its internal processes or indeed, you know, its actual sheer scale and resource footprint. It's quite a bold plan from a financial point of view. This is not an organisation that seems to be hunkering down, saying we're going to try and, you know, do more with less, or whatever those truisms are that get used a lot. They're saying we're going to do more with more. Okay, so that's the FCA business plan. We've got, if you look at the Grant Thornton UK website, you'll see a more substantial write up an analysis that one of our colleagues, Paul Staples, has put together. So please Google that and take a look at that if you want a bit more thoughtful analysis on the business plan as opposed to our take. The other developments in the month. So last month the wealth management and financial planning industry got some of the big players anyway got a bit of a kicking with a letter inquiring about their performance or otherwise of annual reviews for clients. This is where clients are paying for an annual review, you know, have actually got the annual review. That is, you know, as an aside, that's the issue that's led St James's Place to take a provision in their accounts to sort of compensate there. So that's all in the public domain. So that's last month's board side. This month we have got the results of the FCA's thematic review on retirement advice. So basically it's the financial advice that clients receive at the point that they are retiring. It's called, you know, moving into the decumulation phase. So you've accumulated your assets and your pension pots, etc. Now you're being given advice on how to manage that during your retirement and obviously meet your financial needs during retirement. This is thematic review 24-1. I guess the context for it for those that don't know, you know, the pensions freedom changes in 2015. You know, brought in a different regime around things like pensions drawdown, so you could, rather than just taking your pension when you hit retirement, you could, this is your occupational pension, you could leave it and continue to grow it and all actually take drawdown from it, so you could take chunks out of it essentially to fund your lifestyle. As the jokes would go, you know, you could take it and buy a Lamborghini and that kind of thing.
Sounds like a retirement plan.
Yeah. I think that was the, I'm not even sure, is that probably apocryphal that George Osborne actually referred to pensioners going off to buy a Lamborghini, but yes, that's certainly theoretically possible. And you know, so since 2015, according to the FCA's analysis, about 90% of people reaching retirement age just bought an annuity. You know, that's a nice stable kind of fixed income for the rest of your life. Occasionally might have some inflationary element to it, but essentially it's very predictable income. Whereas today, 10% of people in the same position take an annuity. And some of that's interest rate driven, but a lot of it's pensions freedom driven. So anyway, the FCA thought it was relevant to look at the quality of advice. The big risk they're trying to manage here is that people in the retirement, during their retirement, basically run out of money. So their assets are advised badly on, and as a result, they run out of money. So that's the harm they're focused on. It was a, you know, data requests for nearly 1,000 firms, then deep dives on 24 firms. They've pulled, I think, about 70 files, advice files and a sample to look at. It's not a huge sample, but
and there's 70 total, not 70 per firm.
No, exactly, 70 total, 70 across the 24. So, you know, it's like, I think, do my maths here, it's just under 3 per firm. So it's not a statistically representative sample. But they drew, you know, various conclusions from this, which those that review, which feeds the conclusions in the thematic review. These headlines, they think record keeping still pretty poor. That showed up in the data requests, and then in the deep dives. You know, more than half the firms that they did a deep dive on had material weaknesses in their MI that made it difficult to understand exactly what business they'd written and what were advised on. And so record keeping not great. That showed up in the file review as well. 67% of the files were clearly suitable, 10% were likely unsuitable, and the rest were just incomplete files. And I guess it's interesting, they set out the reasons why the files, advice files, failed in from their perspective. And there's a long list of different things. You know, all the classics are in there in terms of, you know, failing to understand you know, other pension pots the customer might have, failing to understand you know, their planned lifestyle changes during retirement. So it's a lot of fairly standard failures, but I guess it's relevant to highlight the areas that the FCA chose to emphasize. So they pulled out a few areas and they've, it's alongside the thematic review, they've sent a Dear CEO letter to all advice firms that emphasize the same areas. So they talked about cash flow modeling. They think that's a good thing. I mean, if you want to get a sense for whether someone's got enough assets and going to have the income they need through, you know, what they're likely to be their lifespan, then cash flow modeling plays a big role there. So they've called out where cash flow modeling hasn't happened, and they've also called out where cash flow modeling has been done badly, poor assumptions, wrong tax rates, you name it. So one of the things that the Vice Chancellor should be looking at is that alongside the thematic review, the FCA published a paper setting out what they think good practice is for cash flow modeling. So some quite specific stuff there. The other thing they've chosen to call out is not considering capacity for loss. And this is the concept that's been around for a long time, but the question for someone at retirement is, if they were to, you know, leave their pension pot exposed to investment risk, and the investments perform very badly, you know, would that have a really material impact on their financial arrangements or not? So and it's a fairly basic area to inquire about, and I think it's, you know, it's one of the ways that annuities obviously play. Annuities obviously, you know, come to the fore probably in that situation. So if someone really can't afford to, you know, they need a minimum income, they can't afford to take a big investment loss, then an annuity actually does the job there quite well. So I think it's probably the FCA's way of saying, you know, for some of these lower risk customers, essentially, you should be potentially considering annuities as a higher up the list of options. One of the other things they produced alongside the thematic review is something called the Retirement Income Advice Assessment Template. So this is something they did for defined benefit pension transfers, and they've done it now. So this is a tool that firms can use to assess their own compliance. It's, you know, sets out all the requirements and can be essentially used as a compliance tool to self-check advice in this area. So, you know, if you're an advice firm, you haven't got a really good reason for not using what the FCA have given you as an advice, as an assessment tool. So that's worth a look if you're in compliance in one of these firms.
Given how much in Consumer Duty and almost every other area, firms are constantly crying out to the FCA, show us what good looks like.
Yeah.
It's nice to see they seem to be starting to do that a little bit more often now.
That's a good point. Because these assessment tools are pretty comprehensive. I think the one critique you might raise is they cover everything, and arguably, you know, you can if you treat it as a tick box thing, then you potentially might come up with the wrong answer, because there's a kind of it's quite possible to have a few fails in one of these because they're so comprehensive. But ultimately, you still need to form a view on whether or not the outcome for the client was correct or not. So it doesn't take away the need for human judgment when assessing the quality of advice. Exactly. You can't criticize the FCA for not telling you what they think good looks like, because they certainly have. There was a quick mention in the thematic review about vulnerable customers, actually in the context mostly of there's just not a great deal of formality in terms of how they're identified and recorded. I think the general sense is that, you know, a lot of firms understand that particularly someone getting to retirement age is more likely to be vulnerable than maybe some other cohorts, etc. So there wasn't a great big push there in terms of how they were being treated. But there was, you know, the rigor around identification, etc., was called out. And that's a bit of a segue then, Ben, because the FCA's made an announcement about some further work on vulnerable customers, haven't they?
Yes, it has. So the FCA has clearly been showing an interest in vulnerability for quite some time now. There was a paper back in 2017 looking at the aging population of financial services. And then obviously in 2021, we had the finalised guidance on the treatment of vulnerable customers, and both of those, when announced, came with commitments that in sort of a few years' time there'd be a review of how effective the various measures introduced there had been. And that time has now come. So rather than running two separate reviews, with one specifically focused on sort of the more elderly end of the population, the FCA is just going to run one review on how firms are treating vulnerable customers. There isn't so far very much insight into what this is going to look like or which firms are going to be involved. Basically, they've said that they'll be looking at the outcomes consumers in vulnerable circumstances receive and whether they're as good as the outcomes of other consumers, and that this is going to be conducted through a mixture of some consumer research as well as gathering information from firms and consumer representatives, with findings being shared by the end of the year. So that's about as much as is known about the actual review itself at this stage. But as you said, David, there seems to be at least a quick mention of vulnerable customers in everything at the moment. It got mentions in the business plan that you mentioned at the top of this podcast. We talked last month about the consumer duty good practice and areas for improvement article that the FCA published, and vulnerability, despite not being a specific section of the duty, was given its own dedicated section there. So I do slightly wonder if this might be one area where I think perhaps the FCA's expectations have been evolving rather quicker than firms have kept up with in practice. So I've a suspicion the findings of this review might not be terribly pretty.
Yeah, I know we remarked at last month's podcast, we talked about the, as you say, the thematic feedback the FCA provided that on consumer duty implementations, sort of good, bad and ugly feedback. And interesting, the very first section essentially in that feedback was dedicated to vulnerable customers. The headline piece of analysis. So yes, it looks like they are getting serious around vulnerable customers, or the industry will be feeling how serious they are around vulnerable customers.
I don't know about you, but the last few skilled person reviews I've been involved in, I think even where vulnerable customers wasn't necessarily the core focus of the review, there's always been at least a couple of paragraphs popped into the requirement notice of, and also consider how vulnerable customers have been impacted or how the firm has evidence that it's considering this.
Yes, I agree. You're right. We don't see or haven't seen so far skilled person reviews that are focused exclusively or primarily on vulnerable customers, but it's just the extent to which assessment and treatment of vulnerable customers is embedded into everyday processes that are absolutely features. Of course, some of the context is some of the FCA's own research about just the sheer level of people statistically that they consider could be vulnerable or will be vulnerable at some point in their life. So, and if they're talking about a quarter of the population being vulnerable by some measures, how can they not expect firms to address that in their processes? So yes, interesting time. We basically started the year with a focus on vulnerable customers. I strongly suspect the year will continue to keep on giving in that respect. Let's change tack a bit then, quite substantially actually. This is FCA finalised guidance 24.1, guidance on financial promotions on social media. For any listeners, I'll be promoting my range of investment products later on in the podcast, so please stay tuned for that. But it's a fascinating read. I know you've looked at it as well, Ben. It shows that social media is obviously such a significant thing from a societal point of view that it now merits its own finalised guidance in relation to financial promotions. Just for those that haven't looked at it spends quite a lot of time just setting out what the rules are in relation to and the expectations around financial promotions. Clearly being aimed in part at audiences like influencers who won't necessarily have a grounding in financial regulation. But then it goes on to deal with some quite specific examples of good and bad practice in relation to how promotions are presented, risk warnings, etc. But there's essentially lots of mocked up screenshots, isn't there, from Insta and Facebook and TikTok and the like.
Yeah, I've actually just realised what this reminds me of is some ancient guidance from back in the FSA days, wasn't there, around clear, fair and not misleading, that had these sort of mock adverts,
mock good practice, bad
practice, and they were all like newspaper adverts and magazine adverts, weren't they?
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And
yeah,
now we've got mocked up, as you say, mocked up Instagram posts and TikTok screen grabs and all sorts.
I think you might be giving away to our audience just how old we are, actually. But yeah. But clearly we are, you know, young and happening types who use social media all the time. So we see this stuff. I think it's good guidance, actually, if you are an authorized firm that's using social media to promote products, then it's essential reading, frankly. I think it's harder to know how it will land with, you know, influencers themselves. So one of the headlines that has gone out is this around this is that this is the FCA putting in the groundwork for sending influencers to jail for up to two years. And that's not wrong, actually. I mean, so one of the things it does is articulate what would be a legal argument, essentially, for why an influencer is conducting regulated activity by way of business, by, you know, providing a promotion, even if they're not being paid for it directly. So they're not being paid by, you know, blankety blank crypto firm or whatever it is to do that promotion. Even there's no commercial relationship at all in that respect. The very fact that they are putting out content on their channel with a view to making money off it, which is, you know, how influencers work, I think, that means they're acting by way of business. So if there's an expectation that their video will get views and they'll get money as a result, then it's by way of business. Now, I don't know whether that would hold up in court, but that would be the basis for potentially saying that these guys are undertaking regulated activity without permission and need to go to jail. So what do you think? Do you think they'll actually spend time and effort taking TikTokers to court?
I suspect not, unless there's something, you know, like almost LCF style with a mass mis-selling, and they can show that particular influencers were a key reason so many people invested. I think the resource to reward ratio on going after someone for tweeting about something that makes a few hundred people invest in something is, I suspect, not there, but I don't know. I could be proven wrong.
I don't have much insight
into the inner thinkings of the FCA enforcement team, to be totally true.
No. Well, rather embarrassingly, Ben and I were chatting before we started recording about, you know, is this the point in the podcast where we name drop a few well-known TikTokers, but we couldn't think of any. So, but I think that's more reflection on us than anything else. It's fascinating. I say, if for legitimate financial services firms, you should be looking at it in any event, whether or not it actually ultimately leads to some influencers going to jail. No doubt they'll live stream from the prison showers or something and probably get a load of views. We shall see.
I suspect that probably is the real intent behind this, isn't it? It's, yes, if the message reaches influencers directly, clearly that's good. But I think in some ways, this is actually almost more targeted at the firms whose products influencers are promoting, so to remind them of their obligations keep a proper eye on all of this.
I agree that, and that's the group that should be all over this guidance, which, as I say, I think is good guidance. You know, it's actually a very very applicable. You can do something with it. Okay, changing tack again. Sexism in the City. A TSC report, was it not? The Treasury Select Committee.
Yes. Yeah, so this is another one of those follow-up pieces. So Treasury Select Committee did some work, I think, back in 2018, looking at sort of gender equality in the financial services sector, and regrettably, to the surprise of virtually no one, found that there is quite a lot of inequalities. And they sort of said, we'll come back in 5 years or so and see how much has changed. And quoting from their own introduction, now they say, 5 years on, we launched our current inquiry into sexism in the city to find out how much had changed disappointingly, the answer appears to be not much. So this is obviously in a similar vein, but with perhaps a bit of a wider scope to the FCA and PRA interests in, well, wider scope in some ways and not others, I guess, because of the FCA and PRA have been looking at diversity and inclusion across the piece. This is fairly specifically on gender inclusion, but within that remit, has got perhaps a bit of a wider scope because it's not just looking at the regulatory angles. So there is coverage of things like representation at senior levels, which is one area where this report finds there has been some progress, and similarly on pay equality, but it's also been looking at how women are actually treated in the workplace to a, I think, a greater degree and in greater depth than the FCA and PRA work did, with some very frankly upsetting findings around the amount of bullying and harassment and sexual harassment that women still face in financial services, and sort of highlighting that, yes, these are societal problems, but they do seem to be more prevalent within the financial services industry than they are within sort of society as a whole, which is clearly not a terribly good reflection on us as an industry. Identifies that things like sort of misogynist banter in the office and open sexist comments seem to have tailed off, but have been replaced by more sort of subtle or underhand misbehaviour. Finds that the committee's feeling seems to be very much that firms themselves are not taking sufficient responsibility for addressing this, that they do the sort of the tick box stuff around having strategies, trying to increase representation, but in terms of actually effectively dealing with misbehaviour, investigations are not always effective, whistleblowing doesn't lead to the outcomes it should, the misuse of non-disclosure agreements, and again, I suspect, unfortunately, a lot of women listening to this will not be surprised to hear that there's a finding that most of the time when people do complain about this behaviour, it's the complainants who end up facing negative consequences, whilst many of the people being complained about don't. They either get away scot-free or they manage to change firms without the reputation following them, or or things like that. The bit that's probably of most interest for our sort of regulatory audience, though, is the... So obviously the FCA and PRA consultations included specific requirements for firms to have strategies and an intention to start gathering data and setting targets in relation to representation at senior levels of firms. And the Treasury Select Committee have basically said, this is box ticking, this is not helpful, and we recommend that the FCA and PRA drop this proposal.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because those rules are obviously in draft at the moment, but meant to be coming into force later this year. Oh, okay. So the TSE is basically... chop the legs out under the, from under them. what are they suggesting something instead?
Not a sort of specific like-for-like replacement per se. There's obviously a wide-ranging set of recommendations throughout the report around ways to try and improve firms' culture, improve behaviour. There's obviously the Women in Finance Charter that many firms have signed up to. There are some recommendations for ways to add further weight to specific elements of that. And I think there are some comments as well around trying to, which again, there is some coverage of in the FCA and PRA's own consultations around non-financial misconduct, particularly for people who are subject to the senior managers regime, trying to make sure that any of them who are accused of this sort of behaviour, that ends up in regulatory references. So that would follow them around the industry for the next 6 years or so. Albeit, obviously, a very fair point also made in this TSE report is that a lot of this behaviour is actually committed by people lower down organisations than that. And how do you get to them? To which the FCA CEO, I think, in his evidence said, well, we're already at the legal limits of our powers. So for FCA to do much more, there's probably going to need to be legislative changes.
Yeah. I've not really analysed that myself. But yeah, he's probably right. I mean, it's interesting, none of the... we talked about it on a podcast many moons ago, but a related sort of fitness and probity type requirement within the Solicitors Regulatory Authority, SRA, and basically a lawyer was initially struck off for what was deemed to be sexual harassment. It's a long time ago, I can't remember all the details, but anyway, they appealed to the court, and the court basically struck that down as being overreach for the SRA. So I think probably there would need to be a law change for the FCA to be going after more people, and or indeed maybe more aggressively even for this area. Although you're right, non-financial misconduct, there's obviously been letters sent to firms and data requests, etc. So they are gathering evidence at the very least. Okay, thank you, Ben. That's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to see that you know, actual draft rules in flight being being critiqued quite so clearly by the Treasury Select Committee. I don't know whether it'll have any impact on those rules. Time will tell. I've got one thing from the PRA, from a supervisory development perspective. This month, it's a supervisory statement 2 of 24, solvent wind down planning for non-systemic banks and building societies. So something very similar is going on in the insurance sector. So we have talked about, if you listen to that podcast, then you basically listen to what you need to know. This is a supervisory statement. There's a policy statement which is going to deal with the consultation feedback, etc. Final rules come into force in October 2025. So it's quite a long lead time to for firms to prepare, banks and building societies prepare for this. As I say, it's non-systemic banks and building societies. So the smaller organisations. It basically, as did the insurance version of this ruling, set out a requirement for all firms to produce a solvent exit analysis. So that's like a plan before a plan, but it also includes things like analysing, setting out potential indicators that might suggest that the firm or the bank should undertake a solvent wind down. So maybe it's no longer commercially viable, or they think the strategic niche they're in is being closed, etc. So whatever the rationale might be, but to identify potential rationales and have a sort of governance framework around deciding, okay, it's now a reasonable prospect that we will want to wind down voluntarily. The second part of the supervisory statement is that once you get to the point where you are you think it's a reasonable prospect you might need to wind down, then you produce a execution plan, it's called, which is, you know, massively detailed playbook on how you would actually go about doing it. Also the governance, etc. around it, etc. So yes, I mean, this is financial resilience territory in partly, but it's also recognizing that the PRA, Bank of England, thinks both the banks and insurers, there will be situations where you know, it's not insolvent. It could keep going, but it's a bit of a zombie at this point, and actually the most orderly thing to do is just for them to exit the business they're in, and to, this is the, maybe like the rules framework to allow that to happen in a way with sort of minimal impact. So yeah, that will be relevant to banks and building societies. I thought we'd finish on something we talked about at length last month. So there's an ongoing FCA consultation on their enforcement guide. And that's notable. I mean, the area we focused on, and I suspect most of the feedback's focusing on, is that it trailed the intent to start publicising not all, I mean, there were various criteria around it, but potentially publicising the names of firms that were subject to investigation. So, you know, as soon as the investigation was opened, you could have your name in the public domain. There's been a slight development on the consultation timeline, hasn't there?
Yes, so I think we speculated, didn't we, this might be one that would attract quite a lot of responses. And I suspect that might be starting to ring true, because the FCA has extended the deadline for responses by 2 weeks. So this consultation was due to close on the 16th of April. It's now going to close on the 30th of April. So by the time you're listening to this, basically you've got until the end of the month to respond to that if you want to and haven't already. And I'm sure you can respond on other elements of the consultation beyond simply the aspect of naming firms, but I suspect that's the aspect that most people probably have the most to say about.
I think that's what I've seen some of the draft feedback that's gone in. Yeah, I think that's right. There's a, you know, the people are trying to tread a line that says, well, you know, it would be useful to have more insights to active areas of enforcement. So yeah, there are lessons to be learned from knowing that the FCA is investigating blankety blank behavior or blankety blank, you know, subsector for a particular issue. But you know, do we actually need to go all the way to actually naming and shaming? You know, is that is that beyond the you're gonna have more negative consequences than the benefits gained. I think that's going to be a really interesting consultation to see how that plays out from a final rules point of view. I think the FCA have given speeches about it. I mean, I think they at this point they seem quite, and they talked about the business plan as well. I think they are quite up for naming and shaming, if I can put it that way.
I don't think the FCA is feeling shy about picking fights with the industry just at the minute, is it?
No, I agree. And then that's not their job necessarily to play nicely, but or play softly. So so we'll just see whether they can be persuaded away from their position on the enforcement publicity. I have my doubts, but we shall see. Okay, so that brings us to the end of this month's roundup. Thanks for everyone who's listened today. There is obviously more information on many of these topics on our website, so please do go to Garthorne UK to see what we're saying about financial services regulation. We'll be back next month to do our roundup, and hopefully I won't be quite as cold-ridden by that stage, but that'll be something to look forward to. Ben, thank you very much, and to all our listeners, goodbye.